Hey everybody, Peter Thomas Fornatale here, and we've got a great show for you today. But before we get into it, just want to give you a word from the sponsor of this new podcast, Keeneland Select. Some great promos you want to be aware of heading into this meet. There's a sign-up bonus. If you bet $300 in the first 30 days, you will receive $100 back into your account. And new for spring, if you sign up for Keeneland Select now and bet $500 on Keeneland Racing during the spring meet, you'll receive $50 back into your account. Bet another $500 and get another $50 back, maximum of $1,000 wagered on the Keeneland Live meet. Still, that's a nice kickback and a really good deal. We want you to use the promo code ITM19 to sign up today. Again, make sure you use the promo code ITM19 when you sign up for Keeneland Select. For more information, go to KeenelandSelect.com.
The race is on and it looks like heartaches, and the winner loses all.
Hello and welcome to the Keeneland Select Players Podcast. This is your host, Peter Thomas Fornatale, back with you for show number 5. We're going to be looking at Friday, April 19th's Keeneland Late Pick 4. We've got a visit coming up in a little bit from the winner of this year's Grade 1 Gamble, Farron McCubbins. That's going to be a lot of fun. I've got two co-hosts today. The first one, you know him, you love him. He competed alongside Farron in the Grade 1 Gamble. Wasn't quite able to go the distance this time, though he has done well in that contest before. I'm talking about the man. He's from Planet Texas, but currently in his adopted home of Lexington, Kentucky. He's the People's Champion, Jonathan Kinchin. JK, what's up?
I appreciate you calling it competing. It wasn't really competing. He ended with 31,000. I ended with a dollar. Actually, I think I had a dollar left, and I bet a straight try at the end didn't hit that, so I ended with zero. So I don't know how competitive I really was.
Hey, all the best players, and this is a conversation we've seen on Twitter, some astute stuff about contests from your new pal Inside the Pylons, JK, where he talks about the advantage player in these contests. A lot of times you're going to be either in one of the money spots or you're going to be down there at zero. So don't wear that zero like a scarlet letter. Wear it like a badge of honor.
Scarlet letter. You talked about books pre-show. I think that came from a book that I just read the cliff notes on, so you'll have to fill me in later.
You're not a big Hawthorne fan? I was anticipating
that. No, wait a second. Hawthorne. I love Hawthorne.
Not the racetrack. I'm talking about like Hawthorne and Melville, Moby Dick, Scarlet Letter, all that stuff. Never mind. We are going to bring in our next co-host, guest, whatever you want to call him, professional player out of Lexington, Kentucky, who played also in the Grade 1 Gamble. And as a pro player, might have a little bit of a different perspective about that question we were just talking about, and I'll get to that in a minute. But first, I want to introduce Sean Borman. Sean, what's up?
Good morning, gentlemen. How are you?
Doing very well. As somebody who is a real professional horse player, as opposed to just somebody who considers himself like an advantage player across different disciplines, is your attitude a bit different when it comes to the Grade 1 Gamble? Are you there to win or finish with zero, or do you have a little bit different of an approach?
You know, when I first started playing in the contest, I sort of just considered it another day of wagering, and if I could build my bankroll up to get in contention, I would do that and try to win it, but I would also treat it as my own money after it had been won and save it to go on and bet with the next day. But I think that's the wrong approach. I think you either have to shoot it all and try to win or just end up with zero, like you were talking about, to really have a chance in that thing.
I think that's right. You're taking a knife to a gunfight if you don't fire it all at the end. But I also have sympathy for the point of view that I've heard espoused by Duke Matisse, another professional horse player, somebody betting every day, who will just get to the point where even though the edge is there to fire it all at the end, he doesn't necessarily want to do it if it's not a race that he feels comfortable putting that much of his bankroll on when he could also just put that bankroll in his pocket. So I was half expecting you to take that same perspective, but there also is the idea that the advantage is such that maybe you just say the heck with it. There are going to be enough contest opportunities in life that I'll come out ahead by being that aggressive when it gets down to the very end. Some of this just comes down to gambling personality, I suppose. I got the impression, Sean, that you had been hanging out with Duke a bit this weekend. How fun was that for you to meet somebody? There's not a lot of people, especially in your age range, and you know, Duke and I are probably about 10 years older than you, but that's still kind of close compared to most people who are in the horse racing business, I think. Was that an interesting experience for you, talking to somebody who is kind of a peer in terms of playing professionally?
Absolutely. I had a great time getting to know Duke a little better, and you know, we had a great dinner at Tony's and discussed some races and discussed ways to improve contests and all the, you know, all the usual racing guy chatter. So no, it was fantastic.
Definitely a little different than he is on Twitter, that one. JK,
absolutely.
Some of your thoughts on the weekend.
It was a ton of fun. Always fun. We also got to hang out with a young horse player, a kid by the name of Hudson Davis. He's a student at Utah. And he reached out on Twitter and we invited him to sit with us in the green room. And so he got a little bit of Ryan Flanders, a little Duke Matisse, a little Sean Borman, a little Mike Maloney, a little Prince of Keeneland, a little bit of everything. So he was thrown into the fire. And so hopefully he had a good time and we look forward to seeing him at his next live money contest. Will be his second live money contest.
Very cool. Great to see the new blood coming into the game. Now, we didn't prep for this, but I realized that we'd be remiss in not at least looking back at some of the performances over the weekend at Keeneland. And I think we should go back to Saturday, Sunday, such as it was, the card with the rain and the level of racing, not quite the same. But was there any performance on Saturday, JK, that you put down in your notebook as a horse to follow or something that you found particularly notable?
Well, I definitely didn't put this horse in my notebook for horses to follow because this horse is kind of burned in my brain as a horse to follow. And that's Rushing Fall. I thought she was spectacular, really special horse. And I think, I don't know if it was maybe Sean that said this or someone said it, but it feels like Rushing Falls, like, or maybe it was Gabby that said it. Someone we've talked to recently said it feels like Rushing Falls been running for like 6 years. And I think it actually was Gabby. And you do get that impression, but when you look at her resume, it's really kind of short versus what you would think it would be. But she's going to be a ton of fun this year to watch run. And she's got shades of feeling kind of like a Lady Eli type, where we could see some special runs from her this year, and it's going to be really hard for people to beat her.
She's terrific. She's long been a favorite of mine and certainly had a great race flow advantage in the race on Saturday, but she did all you can do is take advantage of these situations. She's got that push button look. I do see when I look at the PPs that 6 furlong fraction did come back coated blue. Sean, is this one that you're looking forward to potentially betting on or using as a key going forward, or one you might try to beat off the quote-unquote perfect trip in the Jenny Wiley?
No, I don't think I would be trying to beat her. She did get a very good setup, but she's just the type of horse that is very tactical, you know, can make her own trip and still finish. And those are really the types of horses I like to bet on. So I don't know, you know, where she's going to end up next and know for sure that I will bet on her, but I certainly won't be trying to bet against her.
In the end, she made the 4-5 look like a gift. Not an easy thing to do, but it was pretty simple. Chad Brown running 1-2-4 there. Couldn't quite match the 1-2-3 from a year ago, but 1-2-4, not too shabby. Let's talk for a minute about the Lexington, the 3-year-old race, which actually came back pretty fast. Brad Cox and Owendale. Brad Cox with a couple of very promising 3-year-olds out over the weekend between Owendale and Warrior's Charge over at Oaklawn Park. This one does not have the points to make it to the Derby, was not taken in the Triple Crown draft that we did on the other show, the In the Money Players podcast, but does certainly seem like a runner with some real promise for the future. What did you make of this performance, Jonathan?
You know, I was caught off guard a little bit, obviously. I think like some people were by the horse. Brad Cox obviously deserves a ton of attention when he has these horses, these young horses, and I think that his barn is obviously going to continue to grow with the success he's had with Monomoy Girl and other 3-year-olds. But I didn't really see this one coming. I know that Sean made a pretty big play in the contest on Saturday and didn't use Owendale. So knowing Sean and the way that he reflects after a play, I would imagine he's got a lot more to say about why he missed the horse and what he thinks about the horse moving forward.
Yeah, no, I did. I used 4 horses in that race and was never going to use Owendale. I didn't see this coming at all. He did run very fast on my numbers. And, you know, sometimes horses just improve, especially, you know, under a guy like Brad Cox. I don't know what to expect going forward, but it was certainly an impressive performance, I thought, and totally caught me off guard. He blew me out of the contest. So,
what was it about his paper heading in, Sean, that you didn't like? Just slow final numbers? Any component pieces to his performances that didn't look so good? I'm curious.
I just didn't think he was fast enough, honestly. I had the main contenders in that race running, you know, high 80s and low 90 buyer figures, and on my stuff, he wasn't barely cracking 80. I just didn't think he was good enough and wasn't going to get a great setup. But he really just exploded and blew those horses away. So I was dead wrong about him.
Sueno is a horse who I imagine is going to end up on some of my tickets somewhere, not necessarily on top, but a horse who seems like one to this point in his career, certainly, and probably in the future too, that you can put in your bottom spot of verticals, whether you're talking about bottom up trifectas or third and fourth in supers. Is that the type of play you might endorse with Sueno going forward, Sean?
Yes. If I was to use him, that's sort of the way I would use him is underneath. I don't really, he's just very grindy and doesn't strike me as the kind of horse that's going to win a ton of races against great horses, but he could certainly run third and fourth a bunch.
How did you have the track playing at Keeneland on Saturday? It seemed like there were a couple of wide moves in that race where it didn't. My first gut is I'm not sure how much that hurt them, but did you think ground loss mattered?
I really didn't. I thought that was a very fair racetrack in terms of pass and pace. I thought you could win on the lead. I thought you could win closing from 4 wide. It was just a very fair track.
JK, did you have another note about the horses coming out of the Lexington? Or, heck, we can talk about some of the other races. Morticia getting back to the winner's circle. I've always been a big fan of hers. Nice to see her in the winner's circle in the Giants Causeway. At least want to say that name on the show. But anybody from anywhere else on the card you'd want to mention?
I kind of feel the same way about Sueno. Like we talked about before the show, he was knocking on the door. And he's continued to kind of knock on the door. And he's a sneaky one. He's definitely one that you could use underneath at a price. I think that because he hasn't gotten his picture taken in a while, he'll be a little bit ignored and kind of forgotten. So I liked where you were going with that idea. I guess that we got our answer to, was Chad going to run 1-2-3 in the Jenny Wiley? I think it was 1-2-4. I'm sure he was disappointed with that.
Said with all due sarcasm. All right, let's look forward to Friday, April 19th, this late pick 4 at Keeneland, and we're going to start off with this maiden race, 3-year-old maiden race, 6.5 on the dirt, goes as race 7. JK, we'll start with you.
So we will say this. I know Sean and I talked about it a little bit before the show. Weather is a possibility on Friday, and obviously recording this out a little bit early. We'll try to give some thoughts about what we might do in the event that there's a change in surface for some of these turf races. But I thought the 3-horse Guarana for Chad Brown, obviously I've heard some things about this horse working well, was working with some horses down in Palm Meadows. So you can see those videos on XBTV and has been outworking some other horses. So whenever you see Chad show up with one, that's a maiden that has been working well for a prominent barn or operation like Three Chimneys, whose farm is literally right down the street from Keeneland. You got to figure he's going to have this one ready to rock and roll first out. I like the fact that it's 6.5. I've talked about on our other show that 6.5 feels like the distance to me that you can get horses that it's kind of the most closing friendly sprint distance to me. It's kind of right in between 6 and 7, and I, for whatever reason, I've felt like that always happens in those races. So Chad horses are known for finishing, so I think that this horse is extremely live. It what seems to be a short price. The horses that have already run don't really grab any of my attention. The outside horse, Private Message, has a nice race on debut, was 34-1 that day. There could be a little bit of an improvement there, but we'll definitely need to run if the Chad Brown horse is the runner that he appears to be.
I think a lot of people listening are going to say, hey, wait a minute, when they hear JK talk about 6.5 being more closer friendly possibly than 7. I'm going to take a guess at why you think that, and then you can tell me if I'm right. 7 is far enough that maybe folks are conscious of that distance a little bit more and try to back down the pace a little bit more, therefore ceding an advantage to the front runners. 6.5, you've got some people a little bit more with a go-go mentality going as fast as they would at 6, setting it up a little bit more for those stretch runners meltdown type situations. Did I get it right?
It is that, you know, it came from an experiment I did at Santa Anita at one point where I was just trying to identify what type of horse was winning what type of race, and the races that had the most closers winning at Santa Anita was 6.5, and it made me kind of start to think about why that was the case. I think most people would think it would be 7, right? It's I think most people would think 7 actually happened to be the most speed favoring trip at Santa Anita, I mean outside of 5.5, right? So I think the reason is, like you said, Pete, is I think that people are paying attention to the 7. I think we had Craig Burnick on here one time, and he had mentioned that he felt like mile and a 16th are more truly run races because it's short enough that speed horses still think they can wire a field. When they go to a mile and an eighth, they start getting concerned about their ability to wire the field, and they start rating a little bit more. I think the same is said for the sprinters when you're talking between the scale of 6 to 7. I think that's the same thing that happens, and I just think that these horses – they get these 6 furlong setups in 6.5, and I think that's where they can close a little bit better. I always look for a horse that finishes better going 6.5.
I love doing this show where we, for once, we don't have like this huge hard out time constraint, so I feel like I can ask some of these more theoretical questions. So I'm going to actually do that to Sean right now, another one we haven't prepped for, and this one has to do with maiden races in general. Sean, in a maiden race, are you more likely to listen to information you hear from insiders or try to use information that you can intuit from reading the tote board? More interested in sort of the tips or more interested in sort of following the money? Or we'll throw in a third category, none of the above. I guess we can do an all of the above, a none of the above. What's most important to you when you're looking for that secondary type of information in a maiden race?
For me, what's most important is just what I've experienced over the years, especially at Keeneland, and what my, you know, I guess it's my gut or my intuition tells me. You know, I've seen enough to know what outfits are live with first time starters and which ones should take money and which ones shouldn't. So when I see something that doesn't make sense to me, like an outfit that never gets bet, is getting heavily bet, that means something, usually. And I might include that horse where I typically wouldn't. But I, you know, as far as tips go, to me, they're almost worthless. If the parking lot attendant told my friend Joe, who told me, you know, who else did the parking lot attendant told him? It just doesn't mean anything. So I just, you know, I always try to pay attention after the races are over as to what connections have performed well and which ones overperformed, and just sort of file that away in my memory. And then when those instances come along in the future, you're more prepared for them. But I'm not a huge tote reader, and I'm certainly, I just sort of hate tips. I almost want to fade most tips.
there's a logic to it about the idea of it getting priced in. Occasionally a source will come up that can be profitable, but in general, I don't know a horse player who would tell you they were up lifetime on tips. I would completely agree with that. Sean, what do you think of this seventh race on Friday?
I thought exactly what JK thought. The horses that have run don't really interest me at all. And, it looked to me like the Chad Brown Furster was the most likely winner. But it's also not a race I'm super interested in to bet. So from a pick four standpoint, I would probably, if Chad takes money, which he will, I would just single him and go to the next leg. And then, what I always like to do is in this situation is if he gets beat, I'm probably not going to have the horse anyway. So then you can just play the late pick three.
That makes perfect sense. So, and let's put your feet to the fire about who you would start off that late pick three with, because race eight is next up on our docket. We are looking at a turf allowance spot here for fillies and mares, four-year-olds and up, and has an open look, at least according to the morning lines, looking up and down this field. Where do you think you might zero in, Sean?
Yeah, this is an interesting race. And as Jonathan mentioned, we're expecting weather overnight Thursday into Friday. So there's a pretty good chance this is going to end up being a dirt race.
Okay.
But if it stays on the turf, it looks to me like the pace could be fairly quick in there. So I'm going to try to find some horses that can stalk or that are just finishers. And, believe it or not, there's a fairly interesting Chad Brown horse in the turf allowance of Keeneland. It's a European shipper who's running, 100 time form ratings over there in Group 3 races. And she's probably the most likely winner. But I'm a little interested in Rudy Brissett's Sassy Little Lila. First time with Rudy, who's having a great meet. She's got some early pace to her, but I think she's good enough to sit slightly off these other speed horses and take over on the turn and put herself at least in a really good position to win the race. She might get run down by Chad, but those are the two I'm mainly interested in. And then Jeff Mullins has a filly named Amandine who also is interesting.
So
she's coming from California. I'm not sure, how an off-turf situation or a wet turf situation, I'm sorry, would work with her. But
well, we've been fooled by that before. We've been fooled by that before with Mullins. It does seem like ones that he'll send to Keeneland, he sends them there for a reason. I know he has one locally. Zanza is the French filly that you mentioned first, and then Sassy Little Lila and a little bit of love for the Mullins runner, who is Amandine. If this one goes to the dirt, do you have another thought, or would you have to start over?
I haven't really looked at it. The only one that has dirt form would be Strawberry Tequila, and she's got some pace to her, so she could be interesting on the dirt. But, past that, I really have no idea.
One to keep on the radar and take a look back. If you find anything you love, you can always amplify it with a note out on Twitter. Well, how can people follow you on there, Sean?
I am at Borman_Sean. Just took the name they gave me, I guess.
JK, what are your thoughts, turf and or dirt, in this eighth race at Keeneland on Friday?
Well, I mean, it's definitely tricky with Chad and with Mullins. I think with Chad first, Zonza, the one we talked about, if they come off, I don't think she's going to run. Obviously, it's Chad, and he doesn't typically keep him in, especially for a filly who, if you looked down at her PPs, almost every one of her last works was on the turf. So she's a turf horse. She wants to work on the turf. Her last work was on the dirt at Keeneland, but I would imagine that's because at Keeneland you can only be a stakes horse to work on the turf. So Zones is the one that I'd keep an eye on. Obviously, if she's in here, she'll be tough. Amandine, either way, I'm going to be against. Yes, you're right. Jeff Mullins did prove us wrong with It's in the Post, French bred horse that he brought to Keeneland and ran with some cut in the ground and won easy there. And I remember this was probably a conversation that we had that day about why would you bring a California horse to run on the East Coast on soft ground. But let's not forget, there's a rule that we have to follow. When Bob Baffert sends a dirt horse to the East Coast, he's going to win. When an East Coast guy sends a turf horse to the West, they're going to win. And when West Coast guys send turf horses to the East, they're always going to be overbet, and they're going to struggle to get it done. So I'm going to fade the horse either way. They'll be cutting the ground based on the weather. The tricky part for me here is that, like, Sassy Little Lila is one that I'd like to get excited about. And also Lamari is one that I'd like to get excited about, is four types that if they come off, but neither one of them have any dirt form. They've never even run on dirt, either one of those horses. So it's hard to judge. And I agree with Sean, Strawberry Tequila, who's drawn way outside, and the 16 on the AE, which shouldn't be a problem. If they come off, you'd think there'll be a lot of scratches. And so being four out on the AE shouldn't be an issue. The horse is not on the MTO, but it's on the also eligible. That's a little bit tricky. I don't know the behind-the-scenes rules when it comes to that. But Strawberry Tequila has run on off dirt, wet dirt, twice, and has won both times. And then it's a family thing as well. 5-4-11, the dam, who's had offspring run on wet dirt, 5 of those 11 horses have won. I think you just want to find something forward in these races when they come off with these turf horses, like we've talked about before. These horses don't like kickback. They're not experienced getting kickback, usually running on the turf. And so falling behind in these races can sometimes be a shock to them.
Just looking at breeding real quick, and some back form, though you have to go quite a bit back. Jehozacat, the 9, by Tappet out of Cadianus mare, maybe?
Yeah, I think the horse makes a little bit of sense. Actually, the horse caught my attention. The back in 2017 was running on the dirt, was sprinting on the dirt. So there's a little bit of forwardness about him there, or her. She hasn't shown too much speed in her last two. She is forward, but it's not exactly the fastest of paces in the last two races at Tampa and at Monmouth. But she's definitely one that could be in the mix. She's a Tappet, so they can run on anything.
Let's move on to the feature, the Grade 3 Double Dog Dare, and JK will keep it with you.
Nothing like an ice-cold single, but I don't need anyone else but Blue Prize. She's run well in Kentucky. She runs well at Keeneland. She has the best late pace, according to a couple of different things. I think Equibase had her best late pace. Timeform US likes her late pace. I love that, going a mile and 16th at Keeneland. She's the classiest of the group. She's everything that you want in a single. She's run three times on an off surface wet dirt. She's been in the money all three times, so that's not going to be an issue for her. All I need is Blue Prize here.
Just as a point of fact, not to be too much of a jerk, but just as a point of fact, La Force actually on Timeform US has a better late pace rating than Blue Prize does. But I mean, for all the other reasons you say, and the fact that Blue Prize projects to be well ahead of La Force, I still think it wouldn't change your opinion one bit, but just wanted to correct that. Sean, how do you see this one? Do you agree with JK's confidence in Blue Prize?
Well, I'm double checking right now, but I'm pretty sure Blue Prize is going to scratch out of here.
Oh, you saw something?
I saw on Twitter just this morning that she was going to scratch and go somewhere on Derby Day, but...
Interesting.
I'm not 100% sure.
Well, what does that do to you? We'll come back to you, JK, for a final answer. But with that information, assuming it's correct, and we'll verify by the time we post this, Sean, what do you think is going to happen here?
Well, I don't see a lot of pace in this race for this quality of horse. There's just not much early speed. So I was trying to find something I thought could be up closer on the lead. And I'm going to go with Moonlit Garden. She, she impressed me in the Biotoa at Oaklawn last time. She ran a fast number and has an improving figure pattern. She's 2-for-2 in the exact at Keeneland. And I think she can just get a good forward pressing trip and still be able to finish. So that she would be my top choice.
JK, in light of that information, which has been confirmed that Blue Prize is going to scratch, what do you think of this one?
First of all, God bless Twitter.
You don't get to say that very often.
No, that's something you don't say very often at all. As a matter of fact, I've actually said the opposite of God bless Twitter at least three times today. So here's the thing. I kind of agree with Sean, and I don't want to be redundant. I think Moonland Garden makes a lot of sense. Forwardly placed, has a little bit of finish, not a ton of pace in the race. Electric Force is going to be over bet. Electric Forest, if you don't know, is an interesting horse. I believe is a half to to McLean's Music, who was the very impressive debut winner, who ran a sick buyer on debut out at Santa Anita and had and got a stallion deal out of it and hasn't been a bad stallion at that. So Electric Forest is interesting, always takes a lot of money. I thought Golden Award made a little bit of sense too. Same kind of idea as Sean, with, you know, kind of being forward, can still finish a little bit, has been progressing, has won three races in a row. So I thought she was interesting, but probably a little bit overbet. I think Moonlit Garden obviously offers a lot more value.
All right, let's go to the nightcap. This was scheduled for the turf, so I guess it, from here it's 50-50 if it's going to stay on or not. So no reason to go too deep in the weeds, given that we don't know who's running. But we do have an MTO here. So, Sean, I'll come back to you for your thoughts on this one, and feel free to give a turf thought and a dirt thought.
Sure. You know, I really like a horse in this race, especially if they stay on the turf. Scattered Strikes for Graham Motion really, really impressed me in his first start at Gulfstream last time. He was in just against an absolute beast for Pletcher named Social Paranoia and set. He didn't actually see, he was the best of the speed in a very fast pace and held, you know, beat the other speed horses by many lengths. And some closers passed him. Social Paranoia just blew the race up and drew off by five or six lengths. But he's got really fast pace figures, and I think could be a very nice horse. It was just in a bad situation last time. Now, you know, I wouldn't really hesitate to bet him on the dirt either, as fast as his pace figures are. He just seems like he could be very nice.
That's great
the
info.
MTO.
Yeah, great info there on Scattered Strikes. I'll pause on him for a minute while we get to the MTO in a second. What I love about that is looking at the Timeform U.S. pace line, I believe it falls just short of those first two fractions being coded red. And by the time you get to the fourth fraction, it's actually colored blue for what happened to the race at that stage of the race. But, you know, it's a little bit misleading when you look at how fast it was early. So the way that you look at your pace number, Sean, I think is telling a better story than just what the Timeform US line looks like. That could be really interesting information that's not factored into the way a lot of people bet the race. What do you make of this MTO methodical?
Well, he looks competitive. I mean, he's only run once, went 7 furlongs, ran a competitive final time, and a nice late pace figure was extremely wide on a day where I thought you needed to be more tucked in. I don't think the rail was golden by any stretch, but I think, you know, I've got his trip as 5 wide down the backside, 4 wide on the turn. I think that probably cost him a length or so, and that just looked like a good sort of prep race for the start of his career. So I would be pretty interested in that horse if they come off the turf.
So you'd use both of those in the dirt scenario. What will it be for you, JK, to close out this pick four at Keeneland on Friday?
You know, to talk about methodical a little bit, one of the things I've kind of come up with, and I said I haven't locked it and loaded it yet anyways, but look, the public is the best handicapper in the world, right? I mean, they just are. They hit at a very high percentage, 33% of the time or whatever it is.
More these days.
Right. So the issue that I have with methodical is that on debut, he was 36-1. I'm not crazy about taking a horse who's drawn far outside, who was 6th beaten 15, who was 36-1 last time, and is going to be what? I don't know, like a quarter, an eighth of that price. I mean, he's going to be short because he's the MTO. Look, the horse that I want to use on the turf, I'm going to use on the dirt as well if the horse shows up. If he runs, then it means that they believe that he can handle the surface. But that's the last zip, and that's a horse who's going to be stretching out for Michael Stidham. And if you look at Stidham's stats when it comes from turf sprint to turf route, when he goes from turf sprint to turf route, He's won 33 times out of 150 starts, 22%. And I think that's kind of a tricky move. So to be able to still hit at a 22% rate with a horse that you turf sprinted and then you're turf routing, two very different ball games, I think that says a lot about his ability to get a horse to stretch out. The horse has a pace advantage to me, stretching from 5.5. If they do come off, he'll be forward in either situation. And I'm also a fan of Scattered Strikes that Sean mentioned at the top. I think Sean and I actually talked about this horse leading into that race when he was a first-time starter on a mandatory pick six payout day. He had been working on XBTV with a horse by the name of English B. English B is a horse that ran in a stake at Tampa and was beaten a length to a really promising Chad Brown horse by the name of Digital Age. So Scattered Strikes, he ran in this spot, I was a little bit excited about an opportunity to play him. But Sean was right. Social Paranoia was just a freak, and there was nothing that Scattered Strikes could really do about that on debut. Those are the only two I need if it stays on. And in all reality, those are the only two I need if it comes off as well. I'm going to just focus around those two. They're forwardly placed types that obviously have some competent trainers with some ability, and I think that those two should be able to lock up this late race and hopefully in a way that they'll be forward, and it doesn't matter which way it is, if it's turf or if it's dirt.
Scattered Strikes, from everything I'm hearing from you guys, is the type of horse I would want to really try to build around and maybe even have singled late in some iterations to get some extra value in pick bets before this horse takes money potentially and is sort of exposed to the world as one that should probably be shorter than 7-2. Is that your level of enthusiasm as well, Sean? And what do you think of that strategy in general of trying to find horses like this to build your day around?
I completely agree with that strategy, Pete. I think that's exactly what I would do in the late pick five and pick fours, you know, depending on the surface, obviously. But there's just, you know, if I'm right about this horse, that he should win this race. So I don't see a need to use anybody else unless they change the surface and you've got to go a different direction. But that's, you know, that's exactly what I'm thinking here.
Still one, though, just to clarify, to use on dirt. And one other thing, just to harken back to JK's comments, we're giving out bingo squares here. I think that's another example on your methodical price guess, JK, if JK tries math, fails, a quarter of the odds. This horse is going to be way less than a quarter of the odds should he compete in half this field scratch. This horse, methodical, is going to be what, 2-1 in here?
Well, I said quarter and eighth, right? What's an eighth of 36? Like, I'm over here doing math at the moment.
I'm going to let you do it.
I'm failing. 36 times 8, what is that, 0.08? Oh, 12? 12.5, is that what it is?
I'm not sure. You're going to have to show us your work, JK, and I think you might have to stay after for detention.
No, it's 12 and a half. Yeah, it's 36, which was last price, times 0.125, correct?
To do an eighth, yes, that would be right. So you think
4.5 to 1 is what they say.
Yeah, the horse is going to be shorter than that if the horse goes.
Well, I hate you.
And on that note, we're going to bring in our guest. This is a pre-recorded interview I did yesterday with the winner of the Grade 1 Gamble. And now I'd like to welcome to the Keeneland Select Players podcast, bit of a sensation in the contest world. He burst on the scene in 2017, winning the Belmont contest, coming back and winning a big Del Mar contest, and now, as of last weekend, he has a Keeneland Grade 1 Gamble win on his resume. Farron McCubbins, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Pete. Glad to be here.
Let's start off talking Let's start off talking about last weekend and your big performance. What was your strategy heading into this year's Grade 1 Gamble?
Well, I'll be honest with you. I didn't have... didn't have a strategy. I printed me out a program Saturday. I was going to handicap Saturday night, but then I knew they were calling for rough weather, so I just glanced over the program and threw it down and went to bed. I figured I'd wait and see what the scratches were when I got to the track that day and kind of go from there. So
a very sensible plan when it comes to wet weather. You don't want to invest yourself in all that work and have it be for naught.
Absolutely.
I thought it was a great decision by Jim Goodman to add some simulcast races to the program to increase the betting menu. What did you think when you saw that was in effect?
I don't know. I kind of had doubts about it. I know last in the fall when he had the contest and it got rained off the turf, you know, he left it alone and, you know, we just had to make the best of it. But, I mean, I guess it was okay. you know, it didn't help me or hurt me. I don't do very good with aqueduct or very good with Gulfstream usually. So,
well, that makes sense that you tend to avoid those races then. And it also makes sense that different players are going to have different attitudes about these things. At what point did you come up with the idea of making such an aggressive play late in the card? Or is that how you always approach live bankroll tournaments?
That's normally how I play. I'm not somebody that comes to the contest and sets and waits. I usually, if I can afford it, I'll buy two entries, and I usually play every race in every contest. If it's a two-day contest or if it's a one-day, I try to hit something early so that I have some bankroll to bet with, but I'm usually pretty aggressive. But, you know, I was down to $400 going into the eighth race Sunday, which I had a $500 double into the eighth also, and that happened to come through for me, which pushed me up over $6,000, which then I in turn had to bet half of that in the last race, and I already had a pretty good stand on the last leg, so I just, you know, that's what when I made my bet and went on with it.
What did you like about those horses that you ended up playing in the last? It was a big exacta, if I remember right.
Yeah, it was 8-10 exacta, and it wasn't so much that I liked the horses. The 10 horse was actually my top pick. I bet a big win bet on him. He ended up running second, but you know, it was more of a connections thing for me. It was Andrew McKeever and James Graham. And then it was, if I'm thinking right, Brereton Jones and maybe Larry Jones was the trainer. And that was kind of, you know, I do a lot of hunch betting, hooking up the jockey trainer combos and owners and different things. And it was just kind of a hunch.
Well, those are certainly connections known for having success at Keeneland. So it's a hunch, but maybe it's a hunch that's really rooted in things you've seen happen on the racetrack over the years.
It is, exactly. You know, not many people know Burton's, you know, been the governor of Kentucky, and or, you know, the connection between James Graham and Andrew McKeever. So, yeah, knowing them things kind of help a little bit.
Generally speaking, with your handicapping methodology, you obviously are very in tune with trainers and jockeys and who points where and who wants to win where. But how would you describe the rest of your process? Are you do you look at speed figures, trips? Where do you go when it comes to looking at the form itself?
I'm a big trip note guy. I really like the trip notes. The only papers that I use the Equibase basic past performances, and then I use Daily Racing Form's quick sheets for the, you know, last three buyer numbers. And, you know, I just kind of base it off of that. You know, I like a few different things, horses maybe stretching out for the first time, dropping in class, you know, things that other people like. I just maybe go about getting them a different way.
Your experience as a horseman must help as well. You've owned some really good horses. You've seen all the highs and lows of racehorse ownership. How much does that experience impact the way you look at that paper?
Well, you look at it a lot closer, you know, when you've got some skin in the game. You know, it just, yeah, you do follow it differently like that. But, I mean, I can't say it makes me approach it any different than I have since I started owning horses with, you know, 5,000 claimers up to, you know, looking into a state course for once. But, yeah, it's just more luck than anything, I think, Pete.
that sounds perhaps overly modest. I don't know. But that's good to know that these were the ways you were looking at things before and during your horse ownership. You mentioned your graded stakes success, Bullard's Alley. The horse certainly deserves a shout-out of the fine work that Tim Gleishaw has done with that runner and many others in his stable. Sort of a little bit of an under-the-radar guy who's really done some terrific work. How many horses have you had with Tim?
Oh, I guess over the years, I would say 10 to 15, you know, mostly cheap claimer horses, but Tim's always done a great job with the horses, done a fantastic job with Bullard's Alley. We always knew he was in good care, and you just, when you left the barn checking on him, you knew you didn't have to, ever had to worry about that. He always had him ready for race day, too.
Let me ask about your contest strategy specifically, because in addition to these high-profile successes you've had, I've also seen you near the leaderboard towards the end of contests, where then you're not there at the end. It makes me think your strategy might be described as win or go home, true or false.
Well, yeah, I would say I don't get to go to the track near as much as, you know, a lot of these handicappers do, so... when I do come, I'm usually an all-in kind of guy. I come to, if I've got some marbles at the end, I'm trying to win it for sure.
Is that any different in a contest like Keeneland where, yes, it's a little top heavy, but really you get such a significant prize with that NHC seat and that BCBC seat for the top five? Does that structure, as opposed to some other contests where, you know, maybe even fourth isn't getting anything that significant, do you look at the prize pool and decide how aggressive to be at the end? Or is that pretty much just your betting personality where you're meant to be aggressive and that's what you're going to do to be true to yourself?
I do look at the prize structuring, but it's just me. It's my nature, you know, to be, you know, in the horse racing field. Yeah, I've just been an aggressive bettor. I don't make a lot of backup bets. I make a stand on something, you know, and that's usually where I put all my marbles, and, you know, sometimes it works out and sometimes it don't.
How involved in contest play were you before you burst on the scene at Belmont in 2017?
I want to say I played the Breeders' Cup Betting Challenge, the big contest, once or twice before then. Had a little bit of success, zeroed out, but I had some good first day success, but couldn't finish it off the second day. But then really 2017 was when I started following and playing the contest, and I guess you know Gary Palmisano at Churchill Downs would have some small ones, maybe two or three that we played in. But then I guess, you know, the Belmont contest was my, you know, when I kind of started following the tour a little bit on the live money contest and have, you know, been doing it since then.
Gary's got the Kentucky Derby Betting Challenge coming up. Certainly a big money opportunity on one of racing's biggest days, the biggest day in many senses, of course. Will you be coming back and playing in that one?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I only live about 30 minutes from Churchill Downs. I'll definitely be playing in the Kentucky Derby Betting Challenge. I played with Gary the last two, or maybe the last 3 years. And hopefully this Grade One Gamble was my prep to get me to the finish line here. The Kentucky Derby Betting Challenge. Well, that's what I told Gary yesterday. So we'll see what happens.
Looking to go runner-runner in those two contests. How did you hear about contests in the first place, and how did you get into racing as a whole?
I never knew there was as many live money contests as there were. I always thought there was just the Breeders' Cup Betting Challenge live money contest, and I'd always wanted to play in it. And finally I got my nerve up one year to buy my way in and play, and that's usually what I do until this last couple of years I've won my entry fees. I didn't know there was a such thing. I just thought that was the only contest, and I finally started following on Daily Racing Form and Equibase and Pollock's Reports. I would start reading about tournaments and different things, and that's when. And then when Bullard's Alley came along, when he started taking us all over the country. You know, we would be there on big days, and I would hear about the contest, and that was how I ended up playing in the Belmont Challenge that year. Bullard was running I think, on Friday.
Yeah, in the Gold Cup.
The Gold Cup. And I said, well, if I'm going to be here anyway, I might as well enter the contest. And I'm going to be betting, so I took a stab at it. And then, like I said, I just got lucky and ended up winning. So,
going back further.
As far as getting back into racing, I got one of my best friends. His name is Wayne Spaulding. He was my partner in Bullard's Alley.
Sure.
He's actually the one that bought Bullard. And Wayne got me into following racing. He's been in it way longer than me, but maybe, I'm going to say 15 years ago, I started going to the track with him and hanging out. And I don't know, 3 or 4 years later, he finally talked me into going in partners with him on a horse. And like I said, we've been partners on probably 20 or 25 since then, you know, cheap. We can't afford to buy expensive horses. We buy the cheap ones and hope we get lucky. And like I said, Bullard's Alley ended up making up for all the bad ones we had.
Growing up so close to Churchill Downs, were you a racing fan as a kid?
No. The first horse race I ever remember was when, I don't know what year it was, I'm sure you do, but when Unbridled won the Kentucky Derby.
I feel like that was 1990, but I could be wrong about that.
Yeah, it had to be right then because my mom made a $10 across the board bet for me, and I got back like $160, enough money to buy me a pair of Air Jordans at the time. And that was the first horse race I ever bet, and I probably never bet another one for, you know, till 15 years later.
That's hilarious. See, most people have that story, and it's like, and then they had me hooked, and I started cutting school to go to the track and all this stuff. Well, you were just like, hey, I found a wallet on the street corner one day. I'm not going to go back the next day and look to find the wallet sitting there again. I mean, what was your logic to not become obsessed?
Well, I just never did. I was just a kid at the time, but, I for the longest time, I only thought there was one horse race, you know, and that was the Kentucky Derby because I lived in Kentucky, so we watched the Derby every year. But I had no idea there was a circuit where horses traveled all over the country and, you know, did what they did. And, you know, I've just learned that in the last, you know, 10 to 15 years once I got into, you know, partnering with Wayne on horses. So
it's very cool. How old are you, and what do you do for a living? And then I'll let you get out of here and get back to work. I know you got a busy week.
Sure. I'm 45 years old, and I work in the concrete construction industry. We do foundation work. So when the weather finally straightens up, or the warmer dry season, we're usually busy, and it's hard for me to get to the track, but I try to sneak away on Fridays or Saturdays or Sundays, or if it's raining, I get to sneak away for the day and run down to simulcasting or something. So,
hey, maybe that's was your edge at Keeneland on Sunday. You can go to the track more on these wet days. Do you have a particular affinity for the slop as a result of that?
There you go. Yeah, no, I wouldn't say that. I actually really like turf racing, so I like the bigger the fields, the better. You know, the better the payout. So, So those are the days I do get to go when it's raining and we're not able to work or something. So,
all right, Farron, I'm going to let you get back to it. I have a feeling we're going to be talking to you soon, sooner than later. The success you've had, your strategy that comes to you so naturally seems to be the optimal one for these live bankroll events. And with the twist that you're aggressive early too, so you can put yourself in position then maybe have more chips at the end when a lot of people are going all in. I think it's no accident you had the success you have, and I thank you for your time today.
Okay, Pete, thank you.
Cheers, my friend. And that's going to do it for this episode of the Keeneland Select Podcast. I want to thank Jonathan Kinchin, Sean Borman, and Farron McCubbins for their contributions to today's show. Most of all, I want to thank all of you, the listeners. You make this show so much fun to do, and we really do appreciate all of your support. This show has been a production of In the Money Media. Our business manager is Drew Coatney. I'm Peter Thomas Fornital. May you win all your photos. I need a dollar, 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 that's what I need. Hey, hey. Well, I need a dollar, 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 that's what I need. Hey, hey. Said I need a dollar, 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 that's what I need. And if I share with you my story, would you share your dollar with me? Hey, everybody. Peter Thomas Fornatale back with you one last time just to remind you, if you use the promo code ITM19, you can get some great promotions from Keeneland Select, including an opportunity to bet $300 and get $100, and then again to bet $500 and get $50 back two separate times over the course of the meet. Make sure to check it out at KeenelandSelect.com. Use that promo code ITM19.